The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're all in our satellite offices, the Cycling Podcast satellite offices, Tooting, Not Watford and Mallorca, I believe, this week. Is that right?
At the moment, correct.
Counting down to the Vuelta.
Exactly, yep. Pre-Vuelta, non-altitude camp, 200 metres above sea level. I'm not sure what the effects of that are on of the rarefied air of 200 metres above sea level on podcasting, but we'll find out in the next 30 minutes or so.
You've been riding your bike there at all, Daniel?
I did before the Tour de France, shockingly. TV's Rob Hatch and I had our time-honoured Sacalobra mountain time trial, which I won for the first time this year. I don't really ride a bike anymore. I run, but I do ride once a year at least.
Show the talent from time
to
time.
Was it close between you?
It was quite close. He claimed that a double-decker bus was the cause of... Well, it was very close. It was, I think, about 20 seconds in it. But he's quite tentative on the roads. He's quite tentative with traffic. And I'm much more gung-ho. So if I'm stopped behind a double-decker bus, I'll just overtake it. Whereas he'll kind of cower in the exhaust fumes and then, you know, be choking the rest of the way up the climb.
Oh, anyway. Brilliant. Is this all on the record?
Well, it is now.
It is now.
Yeah. Oh, poor old TV's Rob Hatch. Well, listen, there's been a bit of racing and a bit of transfer news in the world of cycling. Some sad news as well. Maybe you'll give us some of that in your news roundup, Lionel.
I shall try to, Rich. Yeah, lots of racing going on. At the weekend, it was the European Championships road race in a rather drizzly Glasgow. A real war of attrition, really, on a what turned out to be a hard and tricky city centre course in the rain. Matteo Trentin of
Italy. Very unusual, that, for Glasgow.
Yeah, well, they obviously had their two-day summer a little bit earlier in August. Oh, dear. Digging myself in to the same hole again. No, we went to Glasgow. I got out alive after my comments about the Scottish summer, and we had one of our live events there, didn't we? And it was a great trip, wasn't it? I was really impressed.
Lovely.
With our night out in Glasgow. Anyway, Matteo Trentin.
All right,
Italy,
damage is done. Carry on.
He out-sprinted the two cyclocross stars, Mathieu van der Poel of the Netherlands and Wout van Aert of Belgium. So Trentin will wear the European Stars jersey. He takes that over from Alexander Kristoff, who won the previous title. The Tour of Poland concluded. Home victory for Michał Kwiatkowski, who won back-to-back stages, which set up his overall win ahead of Simon Yates. Yates won the final stage. Thibaut Pinot, coming back after having pulled out of the Giro very late on, he finished third overall. Kwiatkowski, Yates and Pinot will all now head to the Vuelta. The big women's race in the World Tour was in Vagada in Sweden. A really beautiful race. I'd not seen it before, Rich, but the course looked absolutely stunning. Lots of kind of gravelly roads, forests and lakes, and really absolutely stunning course. And an equally stunning victory for Marianne Vos, who took the kind of the final right-hand corner. Well, she took not just the racing line, but the sort of super racing line around the corner and opened up a gap and beat her compatriot Kirsten Wild to win that race. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, the Binkbank Tour is underway. 21-year-old Dutch rider Fabio Jakobsen of Quickstep won the opening stage in a sprint ahead of Marcel Kittel and Caleb Ewan. Another impressive win for Jakobsen. As we speak, Stefan Kung is in the overall lead because he won the time trial. The race will finish with its regular finish in Hellersbergen on Sunday. Been a bit of a week for young riders. Over at the Tour of Utah, 23-year-old American Sepp Kuss, riding for Team Lotto NL Jumbo, won convincingly. He won all three mountain stages, took the overall by more than 2 minutes from Ben Hermans, who's riding for the Israel Cycling Academy. In Spain, in the Vuelta a Burgos, another impressive race for the Colombian Ivan Sosa, 21-year-old, riding for Gianni Savio's Androni team at the moment. Very much thought to be joining Trek Segafredo for next year, but haven't seen that officially confirmed. But Sosa won the last stage, took the overall ahead of another Colombian, Astana's Miguel Angel Lopez, Sky's David de la Cruz, and Dimension Data's Igor Anton were third and fourth. Some shocking news concerning another young rider, Adrian Costa, who we were all talking about a couple of years ago when he finished second in the Tour of Utah. He also finished third in the Tour de l'Avenir and rode for Etix Quickstep as a stagiaire. Then he took some time off racing to kind of focus on other things, including travel. Well, this week he lost part of his leg after a climbing accident in California. A huge boulder dislodged and crushed his leg. So really sort of shocking news to hear about a rider who we had thought might make a comeback to professional cycling at some point. Mark Cavendish will miss the Arctic Race of Norway. He rode the Ride London. I think he finished 12th, but he missed the European Championship road race, pulled out of that, and will now miss the Arctic Race of Norway. Not sure when we'll see him back in action. It's been confirmed that Adam Yates will join his brother Simon at the Vuelta for Mitchelton Scott. There's some transfer news as well. Probably the big move that's been confirmed is Rowan Dennis joining Bahrain Merida. We also understand Tony Martin, well, he's certainly leaving Katusha, and according to Cycling News, he's going to Lotto NL Jumbo. We might have a bit more on that in the second part of this podcast. Simon Geschke's going from Sunweb to the, well, as yet to be named BMC-CCC merger. We'll wait to hear what they're going to be called. And finally, the road race courses for the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo have been announced. Well, already coming under a bit of fire because the men's course is 234 kilometres long and the women's course is 137 kilometres long. And the obvious question is why the two races aren't the same distance. In athletics, the women run the marathon, don't they? But still in road cycling, there's almost 100 kilometre difference in the distances. So I'm sure we will talk about that at some point. Maybe cover that.
Yeah, I mean, Feminar coming up this week, but it's not the distance that's the issue, because there are limits on the distance for women's racing, but it's more the terrain. The women's race covers very different terrain to the men's race, but we will be talking about this in the Cycling Podcast Feminar later this week.
That will be out on Friday, won't it? Episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine. Just lastly, before we go on, tickets for the two events that we've announced, our Cycling Podcast live events in November, are selling extremely well. So if you would like to join us in either Clapham on the 12th of November or in Cardiff on the 27th of November, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on live events, and there are links to buy tickets. The Clapham event, we will be joined on stage by Amala Taylor. I'm not doing any singing or dancing, I'll just be watching. So don't worry, don't yeah. Let the thought
bit of
us.
Dancing maybe, bit of foot tapping.
Yeah. Middle class, middle aged foot tapping. I might do that in public.
Daniel's a good dancer. I'm looking forward to seeing him really cut loose when Amara Terra doing their thing in Clapham. Hey, Daniel.
Well, yeah. I mean, my performance at your wedding is still talked about to this day.
Certainly is.
Anyway,
I think a picture of that emerged on Twitter this week.
No, that was a different wedding. That was a different wedding. That was another member of the cycling press pack. Anyway.
Community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. And something I'd like to draw your attention to this week on the Rafa website is a page devoted to the forthcoming World Championships in Innsbruck. There's a little short film around parts of the circuit and a sort of a lot of information there about the course and about the area, and it's really interesting. I was having a read of that yesterday. So go to rafa.cc and you'll find a big feature on Innsbruck Tyrol Road World Championships. That's been up since June, but well worth a look. Now, Lionel, in your news roundup, you mentioned the European Championships. It's a sort of still quite a new event, but it was nice to see a winner, Matteo Trentin, who's come back from a serious injury earlier in the year, and it was nice to see it really mean something to him. And I think he was a popular winner. It was a good race, a bit repetitive on the circuit in Glasgow, and the weather wasn't great, but a bit of a sort of mini world championships, a war of attrition there on those mean Glasgow streets. And Trenton got great help from his Italian teammate David Cimolai, who rides for FTJ, Groupama FTJ. But he really turned himself into domestique for Trenton on the day when they had the numbers up there in the break, and he had to beat the two cyclocross riders, Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel. And yeah, I think Trenton will honour that European Champions jersey. Whether you like that jersey or not, he will certainly honour it, won't he?
Why wouldn't you like it? It's quite a nice design, isn't it? No?
It's okay.
What would you prefer? Do you remember in the 80s, early 90s, the Tour of the EEC, which was kind of the Tour de l'Avenir morphed into the Tour of the EEC and ceased being a race just for young riders? And their leader's jersey for a little while was bright blue with the
yellow stars.
The 13 yellow stars on.
I think that would look nicer. I think that would be more striking than the sort of predominantly white jersey.
Well, provocative in current times, yeah, in these febrile times.
It's interesting, because the reason I remember that is because we asked François Thomazeau during the tour a couple of years ago to go and ask Marc Madiot what he thought, because he won that tour of the EEC, what he thought of the being a sort of probably an advocate for Frexit, if there was any such thing. What did Madiot think of being sort of lumbered with the EU stars, or the EEC stars as it would have been then? Yeah, he wasn't terribly impressed. Don't think he was certainly not framed it and put it up at Shea Madiot.
Well, Lionel, in 1992, Tour de France was some kind of homage to the EEC, was it called back then? The EEC, EU as it's known now, and all of the riders competing in that tour were made to wear the navy blue flag with the, I don't know how many stars it was then, on their sleeves. And Marc Madiot himself ripped his off. He refused to wear that flag.
Well, Robert Miller scratched a saltire into his, because the flag was on the numbers, he scratched a saltire into every single day, apparently. So, I mean, that brings us full circle back to the European Road Race Championship in Glasgow, doesn't it? Which went past the bike shop, Billy Bilson's bike shop, where Robert Miller, well, that was his mentor, Billy Bilson, that's still there in the Salt Market in Glasgow. Well, I mean, I know Glasgow very well, and I know the city, I know all those roads extremely well. What did you watch a lot of it, Lionel? What did you make of it as a spectacle?
I thought it was a good course, but it was a bit too much like a crit course. The balance wasn't quite right over that distance. I thought they just about got away with it in the women's race because it wasn't quite as long. But it could have done with something, you know, stretching out a bit into the countryside. I know, obviously, logistically, very difficult. I mean, one of my bugbears is when we all kind of throw our arms up and say the course is wrong and they should have done this, that and the other. We know that the event organisers are working within pretty tight constraints sometimes concerning which roads they can close and how much inconvenience to the sort of general population they can cause. But from a pure bike racing point of view, it probably needed something a little bit extra just to make it look different for an hour or so in the middle, maybe. And the weather obviously did deter the crowds a little bit, but there was still a lot of people out. And as a battle to find out who were the strongest riders on the day, well, you know, you couldn't fault it. I mean, it was looked like a very tough race. All that, you know, braking, cornering, lots of very slick kind of sort of brickwork instead of tarmac, particularly on corners. You know, there was some pretty gingery cornering at times.
A few potholes. Is that why the cyclocross riders did so well?
It might be, yeah. I mean, it was a test of bike handling as much as and repeated accelerations, wasn't it? Which is, you know, probably why the riders who did well were the likes of Trentin, who's not a pure sprinter, is he? But he's a cross between a sprinter and a rouleur. A couple of cyclocross riders. You know, I saw a bit of bunny hopping, drain covers, manhole covers, and stuff. There was all sorts going on.
One observation. Can I make one observation? In the past, there was a suspicion. Well, it was a fact that these national, you know, riders coming together under their national flag for one day a year at the World Championships often meant very little, that riders were really riding for professional teammates. That doesn't happen anymore. It seems to me that more these days, that riders seem willing, quite willing to, you know, ride for the flag rather than the pro team. I mean, there were a couple, you know, Michael Albassini was up there in that move on Sunday with Trenton. He's a teammate at Mitchelton Scott. And I was looking at them wondering whether, you know, there'd be some kind of, because they're very different types of riders, very different abilities, and whether they might, you know, cooperate in some way. But I didn't see any evidence of that, although he was caught up in a crash, Albassini. But it does seem these days that that riders do genuinely ride for their country when they wear the national jersey.
I think, Rich, that's probably a symptom or a result of the fact that the talent is so widely spread now across lots of different nations. It used to be, you know, the national team events, so the World Championships in particular, you could pretty much put your house on the fact that a Frenchman, an Italian, a Spaniard, or a Belgian, or a Dutchman was going to win. And then it became a question of, you know, who within those teams was going to get priority and who they were going to work for, and you would inevitably get these rivalries that would sort of fester. Now, also, a lot of the national federations are almost treating the national team as a kind of club setup, and Italy have done this pretty well. I mean, the Italian Federation have not been great on a lot of fronts over the last 15 years, not really covered themselves in glory, but over the past few years, they have tried to create this sort of club environment. When the riders get together in the national team, they have training camps throughout the year. They also they do races like, for example, the Tour of the Alps. There were riders who came out of their trade team to ride for the Italian national team there. You know, what we saw at the weekend, the sort of cohesion that they showed was probably the result of that. All the more impressive because Matteo Trentin literally parachuted in from that. We didn't quite parachute. I presume he got a low-cost flight from Poland to Glasgow, which interesting. It's not really interesting. It's interesting for one cycling podcast listener, which is me. My grandfather was a Polish parachutist, and he married a girl from Glasgow. So, you know.
Wow. That was very well set up there. That I'm starting to think the parachuting in line was not as off the cuff as you made it sound. Anyway, I think that's an interesting point, Rich, because now that there is this other event for, you know, elite riders, bear in mind this European Championships, it's always been for juniors and under 23s, and 2 years ago they expanded it to make it for elite riders as well. And if you remember, the 2016 Championships were supposed to be held in Nice, weren't they? A few weeks after the Tour de France, I think a couple of weeks after the Tour de France. And of course, there'd been the terrorist attack there on Bastille Day. And so the event was cancelled and restaged in Brittany. And the winner there was Peter Sagan, ahead of Julian Alaphilippe. And I mean, Sagan was still, you know, very much at the, you know, approaching the peak of his powers there, but Alaphilippe was still a relatively new name at that level. And then last year, Alexander Kristoff won ahead of Elia Viviani, and now this year, Matteo Trentin. You know, the fact that there's calibre winners in all three events will only help in terms of making it an event for the elite riders take seriously. And it's not the same level as the World Championships, of course, but it's established itself pretty quickly, and I think it will. Daniel says there about the kind of the trade team culture amongst national federations. It will probably help to foster a bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is also something we've seen with Great Britain. I mean, they have tried very hard, particularly through Rod Ellingworth, to foster that culture with specific training camps and meetups throughout the year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Harry's. That's Harry's Razors. And if you would like to try a Harry's Razor for a £3.95 delivery charge, you can order a trial set today by going to harrys.com/cycling. That's Harry's, harrys.com/cycling. Richard, are you still shaving with your Harry's Razor?
Well, I don't want to go off message at all, but the other day I actually went back to my old razor simply because I hadn't got round to unpacking yet after the tour and my post-tour holiday, and it was still in my wash bag, and I just, terrible laziness, it was just sitting there in front of me. I don't want to name the brand, but it wasn't as good. Really? I'm not just saying this, it's true.
What was the difference?
The Harry's one is, it's got more blades and it just feels clunkier and more solid and smoother as a result of the more blades. So there was some good that came out of that because I did then unpack and I have now unpacked finally. I thought I might just get away with not unpacking before the Vuelta.
Well, it's coming up soon now, isn't it? But no, I think you should unpack, wash everything and repack.
Yeah, it's all going through the system now, Lionel, don't worry.
It's probably because of the German-engineered handle and the 5 German-engineered blades that you get.
That'll be it.
And that's what the listeners can try for themselves. The trial set is normally £11.50, but as I say, Cycling Podcast listeners can get it for free with the £3.95 delivery charge. And in the trial set, you get the handle, the 5 German-engineered razor blades, foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, and it will be delivered to your door, and you can, well, you let us know whether it beats your previous razor blade brand. So if you want to claim that today, go to harrys.com/cycling.
We're going to talk about some of the other racing that's been going on, in particular with a view to the Vuelta, which is coming up, Tour of Utah, Tour of Poland. Both quite interesting maybe in that regard, but some very sad news as well. And I think it happened a while ago, but the news has just been made public that Adrian Costa, the young American rider, French parents, but brought up in America, lost part of his leg after a climbing accident. And I was at the Tour of Utah 2 years ago where he was a real sensation. I mean, he was 18 years old at the time and he was, you know, up there competing with and beating the likes of Andrew Talansky, who went on to finish, I think, 5th in the Vuelta that year. And it looked like Costa was really the real deal. You know, people were talking of him as being the most talented American rider since Greg LeMond. But he took a break at the start of last year. He seemed burned out. I do remember speaking to Larry Warbass about him because he was based down in Nice with those guys. And he shared a flat, actually, with Will Barta, who has just earned himself a pro contract with the team that will be BMC, CCCC, whatever they're going to be called. Barta has emerged much more gradually. Costa burned very brightly and maybe burned out. And he was very, very, as Larry Warbass told me, he was very, very serious, very young. And, you know, maybe there was a cost to that. And he took a break last year, I think. You know, everybody wanted to see him come back at some point. I have no idea whether that was his intention or not and where his mind was at the moment, but he will not be coming back to professional cycling now because he's had this terrible, terrible accident. And just to read it and to see him in his hospital bed was really and truly shocking. And an appeal has been set up. The target was $100,000 to help with his rehabilitation and recovery from that, and they've smashed that target, and there's an awful lot of support from him from the cycling world. So we wish Adrian Costa the very best. We did have an interview with him at the start of the 2017 season, and he was a bright guy and very, 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 very talented. So really sad for him and sad for cycling as well. But yeah, I mentioned that I met Costa at the Tour of Utah 2 years ago, and it's an interesting race, and it's obviously just been run and won by Sepp Kuss, young American rider on Lotto NL Jumbo, yet another very promising rider to emerge on that team. And it's a lot of us didn't know very much, if anything at all, about Sepp Kuss, and now he will apparently go to the Vuelta. But you know, it's hard to know where the Tour of Utah stands as an accurate measure or gauge of how talented riders are or how they might take that form from that race into some of the European races. I do remember another thing from that Tour of Utah 2 years ago, that Lachlan Morton was absolutely incredible and really dominated the race and rode extremely well, and that and some other results earned him a chance back in the World Tour at Dimension Data. And it's fair to say that so far in his, you know, almost 2 years at Dimension Data, he's not really produced the types of performances that we thought he'd be capable of based on some of his rides in America in that year. And it's a funny race from that point of view. Sepp Kuss, obviously talented, but will that translate into performances and results in Europe? We wait to see, really.
Well, Sepp Kuss Had joined the World Tour and joined Lotto NL Jumbo this year. He'd ridden for Rally last year. Had good results in on the US domestic scene last year. But then at the start of this year seemed to struggle really, particularly in races like the Tour of the Basque Country. In the Dauphiné, he started to show some flickers of better form, but didn't really pull up any trees. I think he did a lot of work for teammates, but he was about 34th on about 34th. I casually
glancing at the results there.
But yeah, his performances in Tour of Utah were of quite a very different level, and I think that says more about the race really than any huge strides that Sepp Kuss has made between June and August, which is not to belittle the performances, but you know, it just strikes me watching the American races, and this is something that is no secret and lots of people have spoken about before, how different those races are, and one key dimension that doesn't really exist in those races is the scrap, the constant scrap for positions, which climaxes particularly in on hilly days at the bottom of the whatever is the main climb of the day. And there are some riders who throughout the course of their career, European or American, never get to grips with that, and that is the big handicap and the big handbrake on their career, particularly you know, climbers who are able to do fantastic things in races like, well, in the past, races like Tour de Georgia, now races like Utah. I mean, even someone who comes to mind is, and who's featured a lot on the podcast, is Joe Dombrowski. I think Joe has made some progress on this front over the past 2 or 3 years, but I remember speaking to people at Sky after his first 2 years as a professional, and this was a real Achilles heel for him. It was just something that he wasn't used to. He'd been used to races where you can move freely around the peloton and basically position yourself where you need to be as he went into climbs. And we've seen many others, even riders who did have relatively successful careers in European stage races, like Tom Danielson, never quite scaled the same heights in Europe as they had done in races like Georgia, where Danielson would regularly look like the best climber in the race up against some of the very top climbers in the world.
I mean, Chris Froome, we had the Young Americans episode that we did in 2016 with Joe Dombrowski, Larry Warbass, Ian Boswell. They spoke a lot about this, about that difficulty of coming from the big wide roads of America with, you know, not many corners into Europe with narrow villages and twisting roads and that scrap for a position that takes place all the time. And, you know, they all talked about that being the thing that perhaps had prevented Chris Froome from really showing what he was capable of until that 2011 Vuelta. You know, bike handling was definitely not his forte. And as you say, Daniel, a lot of riders struggle with that their whole career. Some of them do adapt and you know, become better at it, as Froome did, but a lot of them really struggle, and it's really underplayed that. And I mean, you were mentioning in your news roundup, Lionel, about Marina Voss and the way that she won in Sweden on Monday evening. Just a fantastic example of bike handling and, you know, knowing the line to take, taking it at speed and winning the race basically as a result of skill. And, you know, the skill element of cycling is often underplayed.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just the size of the roads, is it? It's the size of the bunch. I mean, I think 100 riders in the Tour of Utah on big wide roads. It's the same with the Tour of California to a degree. Well, with all the races in America. And then you go to the completely the opposite, almost 200 riders on roads that are sometimes half the width. All of the energy that is expended in either staying in a good position or getting into a good position before a climb, you know, catches up with people on the climb. As you say there, Rich, skill, that is something, in fact, skill is something that is completely overlooked in a lot of cycling analysis, isn't it? You know, we look at climbing times and, oh, well, this time against that time. Almost no one takes into account what was the rider doing in the half hour before the bottom of the whatever, you know, Alpe d'Huez or whatever climb it happens to be. What was the rider doing in the 2 hours before, or the, you know, that every little effort takes its toll, and this is where teams that are drilled and organised and very much together, can give their leaders a huge advantage, because it adds up over minutes, over hours, over days. And that does take some time. It's not, you know, road racing, stage racing, mountain climbing is not just a watt bike test. You know, there's so many different factors that go into it. And it is notable that, you know, riders, I mean, you mentioned Joe Dombrowski, obviously won the Tour of Utah, won the Baby Giro. It doesn't necessarily translate into, you know, equivalent results at the pro level. There's an awful lot more that goes into it. But nevertheless, you know, Sepp Kuss, it's an impressive performance simply because he won all three of the mountain stages, and I mean, we were able to watch a bit of it because obviously it's in our evening time, so it's quite a convenient time to sit down and watch a bit of bike racing. It's a pleasant watch, but you know, it will be very interesting to see how he gets on at the Vuelta, where of course he will be working for other riders in the Lotto NL Jumbo team.
Anyone shed any further light on Sepp Kuss's origins and his, well, genealogy? I'm intrigued by his name. I know that his dad is called Dolph and his mum's called Sabina, which I thought was rather marvellous, but I don't know where that name comes from. And I know that his grandfather fought in Korean War as well.
Well, we'll find out at the Vuelta. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing how he. It's not been confirmed that he's riding, but I think he will be riding, and he's certainly will be an interesting one to watch there, I think. You mentioned, Lionel, that he'd be working for other riders. George Bennett finished fourth at the Tour of Poland, his first race since the Giro. You know, looking good. The thing I like about George Bennett is that he never seems to be content to settle for wherever he is on GC. He always has a go. He's not an Ala Zubeldia rider at all. And he's going to the Vuelta hoping for a stage win, but also with eyes on GC. And I spoke to him. Yes, he was in Andorra where he's doing some final training for the Vuelta. Here's what the New Zealander from Lotto NL Jumbo had to say.
I mean, first of all, you rode very well in Poland. That, you hadn't raced since the Giro, had you? And you must have been pleased with how it went there.
I was, actually. I mean, it's kind of weird. I guess it's the old cliche, the old mixed emotion thing. But on one hand, I was relieved because I've just been sitting up tough on the mountain by myself for 6 weeks or something. And you don't really know. You've got nothing to compare it about. You know, you're not training with anyone or you're not. But I guess numbers are numbers, and you know if you're sort of going well. But on the other hand, yeah, I ended up fourth, and I went backwards on the last day, and not necessarily because I didn't ride well or I actually had a really good day, but just the way the race panned out. So I kind of left Poland, started for the Vuelta, but temporarily disappointed to be. We kind of sat there in the meeting on the last day and said, yeah, we're going to go for it full gas on the last climb, and could result in us winning the race, or it could end up with us off the podium. And yeah, unfortunately we went backwards, but yeah, so I guess generally pleased, but a little bit disappointed at the same time.
But you are a rider who always gives it a go, you know, even if you are defending a position on GC. We saw that at Périgueux last year at the Tour de France, and you see it consistently that, you know, even if you've got a position up there, you're still prepared to have a go.
Unless you're winning the thing, you might as well try and win it. I guess that's what, maybe it's sort of the new culture of the team that's coming through, that we're really sort of looking for wins. And, you know, I've had a year full of top tens, and, you know, it's not so celebrated anymore to have to be three in the top ten, and it's really about trying to win bike races and having a, you know, leaving it all out there and seeing what you're capable of, really.
The team, I mean, you mentioned the team, they're having an extraordinary season, really, and it doesn't seem to, there seems to be a bit of a treadmill there, but it's also the way that you're racing. You sort of hinted at it there. I mean, they were the one team at the Tour de France to really take it to Sky. Is that a culture that's at the team? And, you know, what do you put it down to? The, you know, we just saw last week yet another great rider emerging at the team.
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, obviously there is momentum in cycling. It is something that happens, and a team gets on a vibe. And, you know, it started with Danny winning in Valencia, and then Dylan was winning, and you know, obviously in the Tour, and then Stevie and Rogler in the Tour going, you know, awesome. I've been kicking around, as I said, a lot of, you know, a few podiums and on the top 10 a bit here and there, and So I think that that breeds success, but I also think that that encourages young guys like Anton Tolok. You saw him. I mean, he was having a great tour. You probably didn't see much of him really on team duty, but in San Sebastian, he was one of the strongest guys.
He set up the move at the end, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And then obviously Seb Kuss last week in Utah. So there's definitely that thing, you know, that it gives guys confidence to try, and that there is a momentum factor. But that's almost a pseudoscience thing. I mean, that only goes so far. When it boils down to it, I think it's largely a result as well of, well, you know, mostly the result of basically the sports scientists in our team, and a combination of, you know, like working with sponsors for equipment, working with new nutritionists, we're working with you know, different training methods. We're doing a lot of we're changing up our race programs. You know, like, not many guys haven't raced since the Giro, and I was lucky to go all the way from Giro to Poland without racing, just to be peaking for the Vuelta. And I think that that's a luxury that this team gives to guys. It gives faith in that we can train ourselves hard, and therefore we're sort of more in control. We don't leave it up to the fate of how a race goes to set us up for another race. Yeah, I just think it's coming together, and I mean, also we're hiring good riders. I mean, that's also part of the scouting plan of the team, and you look at some names that are coming next year. I don't know if a lot of them are public yet, so I probably shouldn't say too much about it, but it's a team that's really focused on, I mean, Dylan obviously with the sprint, Danny with the sprint, but the GC train's really becoming maybe one of the ones that can challenge Sky.
What are you hoping for from the Vuelta? What are your aims going in there?
It would be a dream to win a stage somewhere. That would be a pretty serious goal for me. From the peloton, obviously, I'll be riding GC, so I'm not going to have freedom to go up the road. But as far as GC goes, I think if I could sort of break into that top five, that would be a huge step for me, especially with the guys who come to the Vuelta. I mean, you always see it in a year where the tour's been so lethal, and you know, Uran crashed out, Richie crashed out, a few other guys that are now, they crash out of that one, and they go, okay, right, I'll go to the Vuelta. And slowly the start list for the Vuelta just gets better and better. And now I saw three guys from Movistar coming, and both the Yates are coming, and Wilco's been out, he's come. So it's turning into one of those grand tours where maybe a top five a month or two ago would have been a realistic goal, and now it obviously gets harder every day. But I think if I can keep the level ahead of Poland, which was, as I said, a bit of a surprise for us and for our trainers, and probably a bit of hit almost of where we wanted to be. But if we can keep that level going throughout the 3 weeks in Spain, it is a possibility.
So that was the always interesting George Bennett, who, as I said before, we heard from him. He certainly likes to attack, and you know, he's attempting this difficult feat of wanting a stage win while also trying to ride for GC, which means that he'll probably have to beat the other GC guys to win a stage. But that seems to be what he wants to do. Interesting on the team, because they have certainly been one of the teams of the year. Not so many major wins, perhaps, but you know, they were the one team at the Tour who really took it to Team Sky, ended up with two riders in the top five overall, and also sprint wins, thanks to Dylan Groenewegen, let's not forget. So a really impressive team, you know, when you think about where they've come from and the, you know, emerged from the ashes, really, of the Rabobank team, and lost some real marquee riders like Sepp van Marck a couple of years ago, and looked almost directionless and leaderless. And then, you know, through Kruijswijk at the Giro, Primoz Roglic and Bennett as well, to some extent, now Sepp Kuss as well, and Groenewegen and Danny van Poppel, they've built a really quite formidable team. And as you said earlier, Tony Martin is rumoured to be going there, and as Bennett told me, some other big names as well joining in the winter, apparently.
What's interesting is how light a racing program George Bennett has had. I mean, and that isn't, I'm assuming that is not by accident. I mean, he did a Tour Down Under back in January. He did two stage races in March, finished ninth at Tirreno Adriatico, sixth at the Tour of Catalonia. Then towards the end of April, he did the Tour of the Alps where he finished fifth. Then in May, he did the Giro where he finished eighth. And then he's had 2 months off before coming back to the Tour of Poland where he's finished fourth. And
that's a good record,
well,
isn't it?
It's an incredibly consistent
record. That's a great season,
It's a great record. But there's, you know, that to me, yes, he's done a couple of one-day races here and there. But that looks to me like a really kind of well thought out planned season where you can give a talented rider, you know, intense racing when needed, but a lot of rest and training time to enable him to perform as well as possible in the races. And it'll be interesting to see how that pays off at the Vuelta and whether he can back up a top 10 finish at the Giro with another one.
And just on Lotto NL Jumbo, Rich, I was chatting to Dave Brailsford at the end of the Tour de France about...
Is that him in the background, barking?
Or is that Mark Cavendish?
About what other teams were doing to bridge the gap to Team Sky in terms of sports science particularly. And he named Sunweb and Lotto NL Jumbo as two of the most impressive outfits on that score. And I imagine that Lotto NL Jumbo and Sunweb as two Dutch teams, and within the respective backroom staffs, there are various people who have moved from one to the other. There's a certain amount of rivalry, and they'll certainly be pushing each other, I think. And I think that process possibly started, or a key figure in that process has been a guy mentioned in last week's podcast, Marijn Zeeman, who moved in 2012 from what was then Argos Shimano to Lotto NL Jumbo. And I think, yeah, he's been the driver of a lot of the progress that's been made over the past couple of years by Lotto NL Jumbo. But if, as seems to be the case, they're going to have a bit more financial heft behind them, then Lotto NL Jumbo are certainly going to be a team to watch over the next couple of years. Interesting mooted signing in Tony Martin. I've seen a lot of sort of people express fairly forthright judgments on whether that's a good or a bad signing. I mean, my view on that is it comes down simply to how much they're paying him. You know, when Katusha signed him a couple of years ago, I thought he was the kind of rider who would perhaps be liable to, he was likely to be overpaid at that point. He was a rider whose performances seemed to be plateauing, but he had a high profile and a prestigious palmarès, but he wasn't necessarily going to continue in the same vein over the next couple of years. That's proven to be the case, but he's certainly someone who can still produce good performances on his day, and I would suggest that his value or what Lotto NL Jumbo are going to pay for him is going to be considerably less than what Katusha Alpecin paid for him.
Well, they might have benefited from having him in their team time trial team at the Tour de France, where they lost quite a lot of time. There's a good film, interesting little film on the Lotto NL Jumbo website about Primoz Roglic and where he came from and his background as a ski jumper, and how he was spotted by the team and Frans Maassen and brought over to Holland and tested and developed in the way that he's developed the last couple of years. Really, really interesting little watch about a rider that we don't know too much about. 20 minutes long, I think it is.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Okay, our question this week is a fascinating one. It's from Stephen Hodge. Hi guys, always suitably entertained by your show. Thank you, Stephen. Wondered if Science and Sport could shed some light on as to why, if I have fish and chips the night before a big ride or event or a race, that I ride so much better the next day compared to if I have something more what you would assume to be suitable, such as a rice dish. As always, great show, and thanks for entertaining me during my day. Thank you, Stephen.
That's a really interesting question, and I suppose I can only guess at the exact mechanisms involved in your fish and chip fueled performance. But one thing I would say is the fish and chips provide protein, and they provide carbs, and they provide fat. So the protein potentially could help a bit of muscle recovery. The carbs will obviously help with some fueling. And the fat that's in the batter isn't of the best nutritional value, but again, it does provide some fuel. It may be that simply by consuming the fish and chips, you're actually providing your body with more calories than you consumed when you had a rice meal. I think if we had a rice meal with some high quality protein with the same number of calories in, I'd expect you to outperform fish and chips.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Science and Sport, for their continuing support. And you can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's scienceandsport.com, SISCP25. CP25. Talking before the break there about Lotto NL Jumbo and George Bennett, who was fourth at the Tour of Poland, and that was a real curtain raiser for the Vuelta. If you look at the top four there, Bennett, Pinot, Yates, Kwiatkowski, all will go to the Vuelta, and there wasn't much to separate them at all at the Tour of Poland, and it was an absolute humdinger of a final stage there. Simon Yates was away on his own, and at one point was the virtual yellow jersey. Kwiatkowski was pretty isolated, but he rode a pretty canny race, and in the end the gap came down enough that Kwiatkowski was able to hold on to win overall by just 15 seconds. But I was very, very impressed by Simon Yates, who we've not seen a lot of obviously since the Giro, and you know, having gone so close at the Giro and yet so far finishing about an hour and a half down overall, I think, in the end. But you wonder what he will go to the Vuelta, you know, you wonder what his ambitions will be going to the Vuelta with Adam Yates obviously at his side there as well.
I think he can have genuine realistic ambitions to win that race. I mean, he's going to have taken an awful lot of confidence from the Giro, certainly up until the middle of the final week, and the course will suit him. This was where he really had his breakthrough in Grand Tours in 2016. He finished in the top 10 there and was invaluable to Esteban Chavez as well. So I don't think there's anyone in the Vuelta field, although it's a good field, who's going to intimidate him. Nibali has said that he doesn't really have general classification ambitions after his crash in the Tour de France. You've got guys like Aru, who's still struggling to rediscover his best form. And then I think Pino will be strong. We saw other guys that, like you said, at the Tour of Poland will be strong. Likes of Sam Omen and Wilco Kelderman will be there as well. And then Movistar have their Trident, which was a sort of mitigated success, I would say, at the Tour de France. So I don't think there's anyone there who will strike fear into Simon Yates or into Mitchelton Scott.
So, I mean, I think the Vuelta might suit the Yates twins better than any of the other Grand Tours with the, you know, the type of course, the type of climbs. But if Simon Yates was to win the Vuelta, or indeed Adam Yates, that would be quite an incredible statistic for this year, wouldn't it? If you look at the three Grand Tours and the winners thus far of those Grand Tours.
I mean, this is speculation deluxe, isn't it? But you're three British riders, different British riders winning the Grand Tours. Yeah, well, that's certainly never happened before.
No, I don't believe it has. Let me just check the cycling records. No, I can't see that having ever happened before. Anyway, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves there. It's going to be interesting, I think, to see how those guys get on and how the experience of the Giro, you know, if Simon Yates is in a position in the final few days, you know, to win it or to be on the podium, how that Giro experience affects him or doesn't, I think, will be interesting.
I think he'll be hoping and he'll be thinking that the Giro experience will stand him in the same kind of stead as the Vuelta in 2015 stood Tom Dumoulin. Tom Dumoulin, of course, there was leading to most people's surprise in a similar fashion to Simon Yates. The Giro was leading and had a bit of a collapse, which was at the time was put down to illness, but Dumoulin subsequently admitted that, you know, the stress had really started to get to him and that maybe caused him to fall ill, and I think that, you know, that happened at a similar age, and Simon Yates will hope that he's on a similar trajectory, and I think he can be.
We talked a lot last week about Jan Ullrich and his problems, but things really took a turn for the worse, didn't they, after we discussed the issues in Mallorca where he gate crashed a party to which he hadn't been invited. And you described it as sort of tragicomic, Daniel. He then travelled back home to Germany and things, as I said, took a really darker turn there.
Yeah, they did. It was on Friday morning I was sort of refreshing news. I was collecting more reaction to what happened the previous Friday, and then a new headline came up that he'd been arrested. And initially, I thought that perhaps because he travelled to Germany supposedly to undergo therapy, that there was some carryover from the offence or the crimes that he'd allegedly committed in Mallorca, that he was somehow liable or could be arrested in Germany. That wasn't the case. It was a completely new and much more serious allegation. he had allegedly attacked a prostitute in a hotel in Frankfurt, and more details emerged over the next few hours that he'd allegedly tried to strangle her, and he then resisted arrest, and there was a further incident as he was moved from police custody into some kind of psychiatric clinic. And now, a few days on, so still only 5 days on, he's supposedly in a clinic, in some kind of detoxification clinic, not too far from Frankfurt. And he'll be there for, I think, about 6 weeks. And in the meantime, the police in Frankfurt are investigating. The alarm bells immediately started to ring when I read that the division of the police that was investigating was what they call the murder commission, or the branch that looks after murders. And the charge is likely to be, well, the main charge is likely to be attempted murder. There are other offences that might compound whatever justice comes his way, so possession of drugs, and again resisting arrest. There are previous convictions, albeit a previous conviction in Switzerland in 2014 for drink driving, for which he received a 21-month suspended prison sentence, and that might also make matters even more serious. But it's escalated incredibly quickly, and the German tabloid press is pretty aggressive. And I said last week that it wasn't a great idea, and from Jan Ulrich's point of view, to commit an offence like it seems now pretty light and trivial of gate crashing a neighbour's party in Mallorca, because there's a big presence, the German media in Mallorca. But since Friday, it's really been open season, and Ulrich's entourage now seems to be a fairly motley crew of friends and advisors that have stumbled into his inner circle in the last few months, when he's really spiraled since his wife left him in March, and they're not really offering him much protection. Former friends are coming out of the woodwork, and I was quite struck the other day. I read an interview with Matthias Kessler, who's a former teammate of Jan Ulrich at T-Mobile, and who had a terrible accident a few years ago, I think a cycling accident, and is quite severely injured, and the legacy of that injury has really affected his life over the past few years. But I was under the impression that they'd become very close friends, and indeed I think they were close friends for a while, but Matthias Kessler's given an interview in the last few days in which he said that Jan Ulrich should expect no sympathy from him, because he's ruined his life on his own, and it's up to him to straighten it out. So quite shocking, really.
Yeah, shocking developments indeed, Daniel, and it doesn't seem that Jan Ulrich is going to have the luxury of tackling his problems away from the public eye. Shall we talk, before we finish, about the upcoming Tour de l'Avenir? You guys know how much I love speculation, and there's no finer speculation than guessing which of the young riders are going to be the stars of tomorrow.
Who's going to win it? Who's going to win the Tour de l'Avenir?
Well, I'm going to say Ivan Sosa is going to win it, because he is the standout name in the field. The Colombian rider, he's just won a very high level race, the Vuelta a Burgos. He will be leading the Colombian team. I think that's one of the things about the Tour de l'Avenir. I mean, on the one hand, it's a great indicator of future. A future potential, or rather current potential, turning into future results. If you look at the last eight winners, going backwards, last year's winner was Egan Bernal. Before that, it was David Gaudu, Marc Soler, Miguel Angel Lopez, Ruben Fernandez, Warren Barguil, Esteban Chavez, and Nairo Quintana. Of those eight riders, really only Ruben Fernandez has not kind of shown, the potential yet to slot in at the very high level in the elite ranks.
Has he not?
Well, has he?
Guaranteed. Now he's gonna win at least a stage of the Vuelta, isn't he?
Well, maybe he will. Yeah, but I mean, compared to the other seven,
We're still waiting for a really big result for David Gaudu.
True. But yeah, I mean, he had a, I think had a good tour. Just good
pure,
tour
I just purely said that in order to say that we're waiting for Freddie.
Anyway, the Tour de l'Avenir, it starts on Friday. It's a 10-day stage race. This year it goes from Brittany all the way across the kind of middle of France in a sort of, well, a diagonal, almost a sash across to the Alps. We'll finish with the most difficult mountain stages. And I think one of the issues is, you know, the outstanding rider of that particular year tends to win, and then, you know, that their talent is confirmed. It's not necessarily, you know, we always kind of get lured into the language of young riders. Well, all sports do. Oh, there's a great crop of young riders. Well, there kind of always is a great crop of young riders. I mean, the one thing that no one can do in sport or indeed life is kind of slow down the aging process. Today's world-class riders will get weaker, and tomorrow's world-class riders will take over from them. I mean, what is interesting, though, is how the World Tour teams are going about their kind of talent identification. We've talked a lot about Quickstep, and I mean, you know, they continue to bear the fruits of all of that scouting work, really sort of looking 2, 3, 4 years down the line. I mean, even looking at Fernando Gaviria last year, even Fabio Jakobsen, who's won a stage at the Binkbank Tour, you know, at 21 years of age, you know, there's not many riders that sort of come in and deliver results at that young age. And the teams are, you know, they're looking for the next crop of talent, because, well, that's where they need those riders to come through. They need to spot them before their rivals do. And during the Tour de France, I spoke to Brent Copeland, the manager of Bahrain Merida, and it was a day or two after they had announced that they'd signed Stevie Williams, a young rider from south of Wales, from Newport, who finished fifth in the Baby Giro. He led for a day and won a stage as well. Quite an eye-catching performance. And he'll be in the Great Britain team at the Tour de l'Avenir. But I kind of, as I spoke to Brent Copeland about how they, you know, whether it was just that result at the Baby Giro that persuaded them to take a punt. Were they taking a punt, or had they kept their eyes on Stevie Williams over sort of a year or 18 months? And well, the picture he painted was that the business of talent identification is getting ever more serious, and that may have some ramifications for young riders themselves.
Brent, you've just signed Stevie Williams as a stagiaire with a contract for next season as well. When did you first notice him? Was it before the Baby Giro, and was it the Baby Giro that convinced you to take a chance with him?
We noticed him before that at Liege, Bastogne Liege under 23. We saw that the quality he had in the Ardennes Classics or the Ardennes races is always a good point to notice riders, and we saw the way he raced, the way he was racing up front, and the results he got. So that was the first time we actually noticed him, and then we started speaking to SEG, where he races. We're obviously in contact with them, with a lot of riders that they have. Then at the Giro, baby, his results convinced us of his talent, and it's a great signing for us. We're really pleased to have him come on board, and we're looking forward to working with him. Obviously, he's got a lot of margin of improvement, and a young rider that he is. The climber is something that we're looking for on this team. So we looked at it with our technical staff to see where we could place him and where he could fit in, and we're convinced we can find a good spot for him.
Is the fact that he's a young British rider important to you and important to the country that's sponsoring you?
The importance is always the young riders. That's one of the main important things that we look at. That's one of the strategies that we look at when bringing on riders. You know, these youngsters, they become so good so quickly. Before you know it, they're sitting on the podium of Grand Tours or at least 1 week races. So the age is something that we definitely look at. And then internationally, we're always looking at making the team more and more international, which we feel is important for all our sponsors that support the team and all our partners.
In terms of how you will develop him, what is your attitude to developing a talented young rider? How much will you expose him to in the period when he's a stagiaire in terms of the races he does?
Well, stagiaire, we'll just have him do the one-day races in Italy, which are not too stressful. And just, it's more about getting him to know the environment of the team, getting to know the people that are working on the team, and just how the team works. This is important for us. It's not so much about results or the actual racing. This is more important to us. So we'll work with that with him, and then we'll sit down towards the end of the season with the technical staff and the trainers, and we'll put a program together for the future to see how we can build him up into becoming a GC rider, because that's where we feel his place will be. In the beginning, maybe the Ardennes Classics is where he can get some experiences in the World Tour, and then the first year, maybe one Grand Tour. But like I say, we've got to sit down and look at his files, look at his training, what he's been doing in the last few years, and then make a decision for the future.
How important is all that data when you sign a young rider? Do you want to look back at all of that performance data and find out what rate of progress they've been making to that point?
It's becoming more and more important. It is, yeah. Especially with the young riders, we normally always do a test with our trainers before signing them on. So with Stevie, it was different. We just been watching him for a while, and we saw the results that he got at Baby Giro is really talented. So we didn't have to do that step. But it is becoming more and more important for teams to sign riders up, and they are starting to look more and more at the numbers. I was actually talking to your colleague the other day about this, and it's in the future it's probably going to become like a money ball situation where teams are going to put down a statistics system before signing up riders, because the data is always important, and it is becoming more and more important.
So 16 and 17 year olds should be getting themselves a power meter and keeping their data files, so that almost like a CV for the future if they're really serious about becoming a pro, maybe.
As much as I hate to say it, it's probably moving in that direction. I say that because this just takes away the fantasy of cycling, and it forces the youngsters to train and race in a different way that they should be at that age. At that age, they should be enjoying it. They should be thinking about why they ride in the bike and not so much the numbers. But like everything in life, unfortunately, the technical side is taking over a lot, and it's difficult to keep them away from that. So, yeah, it's the way that the world's going.
Nevertheless, a talented free spirit will still make it, but the way that the sport is moving, everything is being analysed down to the finest detail, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Like in most sports, it's...
In terms of the search for young riders, I mean, how quickly do you have to move with someone doing well in the Baby Giro? Other teams will have been aware of him, looking at him. Do you have to get in quick?
It's becoming more of a race to find the youngsters, especially when you find a young rider as talented as Stevie. The teams saw him at the Giro, I'm sure, and a lot of teams were after him. So yeah, it's by the time the Giro finishes till now, we've been negotiating a lot with his manager and agent, and with his team SEG where he's racing. So it moves quickly.
So to answer your question, Richard, Ivan Sosa is going to win the Tour de l'Avenir, and Stevie Williams will win a stage. There we are. Maybe wow.
Can I make a tip?
Go on.
I think Brandon McNulty of the United States will do well and finish in the top three, because he first came to my attention at the Tour of Dubai this year. He came agonisingly close to a stage win at Hatterdam, and has ridden pretty well ever since. Third in the Tour d'Alsace recently, seventh overall in Tour of California. He usually rides for rally cycling, 20 years of age, and I can see him in the next couple of years certainly moving up to World Tour level.
So I'll break my rule about not speculating by only speculating on under 23 races. What can go wrong?
What on earth? What on earth can go wrong? One, I don't... Forgive me if I missed this in your news roundup, Lionel, but one other, your mention of Fernando Gaviria just reminded me that Fabian Puerta, the world Kirin champion, who is Fernando Gaviria's brother-in-law, has tested positive for an anabolic steroid, which is pretty serious, Colombian rider. You didn't mention that, did you?
I didn't, no. You're right.
No, but you know, quite a big star of track cycling, and the link with Fernando Gaviria is probably not something that Gaviria will relish or welcome. He's married to Gaviria's sister, Juliana. Shall we wrap things up?
If you insist, Rich.
is that all? Anything else for this week?
No, pretty packed. Pretty packed episode there.
What's this cafe stop on the... And what's this chat about the cycling podcast Femina is staging its inaugural, is it a century ride you call them? 100
no,
kilometer
ride? No, it's a Rafa Women's 100, 100 kilometer ride. Full details of that will be in this week's cycling podcast Femina.
Well, it's fabulous. That's coming up it's on fabulous, Friday. And I'm all in favour of it, Rich, but I'm not in favour of the cafe stops.
Well, you know,
we've
I mean,
this,
it's...
We've had this conversation before on the podcast, haven't we? You know, you asked me yesterday when we decided what time we were going to record, you know, think of things to talk about, and this has been on my mind all week. Cafe stops do not belong in bike rides, as far as I'm concerned.
I could not disagree more strongly.
No.
I'm very much in favor of cafe stops.
At least it's not a cake stop.
Well, cake stop is implied in cafe stop, I think, and I'm very much, I prefer the cafe stop bit to the cycling bit, if I'm honest, these days.
Yeah, so, I mean,
I'm a big fan of a cafe stop.
My biggest challenge is making the cycling part last longer than the cafe part. What's the objection to a cafe stop? It's very sociable, civilised.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Lionel.
No, I'm not.
Wonderful.
The clue is in the question. No, it should be really good. That is September the 15th. There are Rafa Women's 100 rides happening all over the world. Some of them don't involve a cafe stop. Some of them are pretty serious. But the cycling podcast Femina ride, which is being organised by Hannah Nicklin and led by her, is, you know, it's for hopefully listeners of the cycling podcast to come along and meet each other. And Orla Shinawi and Rose Manley will be there on hand. I'll be at the Vuelta, sadly. Cycling podcast Femina is coming out this Friday. We have just released the latest installment of the Espoir Diaries, episode 5, following young riders in Belgium. It includes a bit from a post-tour crit, a Derny crit, where Kira McVitie raced against Frank Vandenbroek's daughter, who, funnily enough, won the race. Which I don't think there was anything remotely dodgy about that. I'm sure she won it fair and square. But that's very entertaining in the latest episode of the Espoir Diaries. You can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to hear that and lots of other stuff as well. That's all for now. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.